Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Women are really making waves in science. For example, there's cancer researcher Dr. Linda Polarski, who's collaborating with other nanoscientists to develop lab-on-a-chip technology. This will revolutionize the diagnosis and treatment of cancer. Another nano pioneer is Dr. Deborah Ralston of the Naval Research Lab in Washington, D.C. She's working on fuel cells and the fabrication of nanomaterials. Even so, women still have a long way to go to break through the male bastion that still dominates the tenured hierarchy at our universities. And Deborah's acting on that gender disparity in science through something called the Title IX Challenge in the United States. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. My first introduction to nanotechnology was a presentation at a writer's club dinner by Drs. Linda Polarski and Chris Backhouse. Chris is an engineer at the University of Alberta. He's developing something akin to the magical medical tricorder portrayed on the show Star Trek. Linda is a scientist who will use this device in her research at the single cell level in analyzing myeloma, or cancer of the blood and bone marrow. Linda Polarski's lab is at the Cross Cancer Institute. She holds a Canada Research Chair in Biomedical Nanotechnology, and she's a professor of oncology at the University of Alberta. I spoke to her about her Cross appointment to the National Institute for Nanotechnology and her thoughts on the ethical issues raised by nanotechnology.
The mainstream part of my work is actually cancer research, and actually it's called translational research. And it's actually looking at cancer the way it happens in people, not in dishes and not in mice, in patients. So we get patient samples all the time. And because we look in patients, it's harder to do research when you actually want to look at what happens in patients. And so as a result, I'm always keeping my eye open for exciting new ways to be able to do more with patient cells. And that was how we got started and how my cancer research interests have somehow been linked with interests of engineering colleagues here at the university and actually across Canada to try and develop new technology where the kinds of things we actually do in the lab, which are often fairly complex, quite expensive, and difficult genetic types of assays to understand cancer and how it changes in a patient, we can develop technology, at least my engineering colleagues are quite confident we can develop technology that would actually let us allow a clinical lab to do that for very little money without specialized personnel. I mean, in theory, you could actually just have somebody off the street do it. Now, obviously, nobody's going to do that. But it does mean that really complex, expensive testing that actually would be really of benefit to patients can actually then go to the clinic and be used feasibly because it's inexpensive. And because it's not complex, anybody can do it. And it means that it can really improve diagnosis and particularly monitoring, which means the docs can then go ahead and develop therapy that's actually designed to fit the cancer in each patient.
Well, you've developed this interesting relationship with the lab on a chip people, Chris Backhouse and that. And the work you've been doing has actually taken you down to the single cell level. What's happening there?
Well, before I ever met Chris and got involved in the nanotechnology arm of things, the actual technology as opposed to the research, basic research parts, we actually had been forced, as it were, to the single cell level anyway. And that's why I guess I was so excited when I first met Chris, because we're already doing molecular and genetic analysis of individual cells out of cancer patients. So we can actually say cancer really isn't a homogeneous lump. There are a whole lot of different genetically variant cells within a lump, and it's because of those cells. Some of them are really bad, and the really bad ones are the ones that actually kill patients. So we need to know they're there, and we need to know how to target them. And you can't easily know they're there at a clinical level without fancy technology, and you can't do it if it's too expensive. And so when Chris came and said, well, I can make a lab on a chip that's the size of your thumb, and actually can move individual cells one at a time and assay their genetic profile and then spit it out on a computer screen, I thought, wow, I not only would like to do that for patients, it would help what I do in my lab, my research program. I could use that. So I was just very, very excited when he first told me the kinds of things you could do on lab on a chip. And since then, we've actually been working together for, it's about 3 years now, to try and actually take the complex, expensive things I do in my lab and actually put them onto a simplified platform that Chris can design as a small, you know, size of a microscope slide or less, that could actually be used in a handheld device so that, in theory, if I was on Mars and thought I had cancer and had a needle to take a biopsy, I could actually do that, put it into this little device and upload the information, and some computer would say what my cells look like and then read it to, say, a clinician down on Earth. And actually, I could be diagnosed and treated at a distant location. So up north or at the Antarctic, even rural Alberta, where you might be a long distance from a hospital, but you could get to a healthcare center, and you could do the same kind of testing I could do in my lab if we had these devices actually being manufactured.
Well, no wonder the Nanotechnology Institute has hired you as among its first set of researchers. With all of this, how does it apply to cancer patients? How useful will it be for them?
I think it's going to be a whole change in what can be done with cancer patients because, as I mentioned earlier, one of the problems with cancer is that they're often aggressive variants. And those variants gradually, if they have a growth advantage, will expand in number, and they'll gradually begin to take over the clone of the cancer. And when that happens, clinically, it would be wonderful if we could know that, because then that would allow the clinicians treating the patient to immediately know, oh, we've got to intervene with another treatment. Because now this is getting out of control. It's no longer responding to the one we have. And they would be able to identify these variant cells quite early, as opposed to late when it might be too hard to control them. So I think what this means is that it's going to be one of the first uses of nanotechnology that's going to really benefit the general public. And the reason I think that is because they'll actually be able to not only design their treatments, but by knowing what's there, they'll actually be able to design specific treatments to target the cancer in each patient. So basically custom tailoring. And that's really quite important because now the docs use the arsenal that they have, and if a patient doesn't respond, they don't know why, and they simply have to try another agent. But if we had ways of knowing what was there and what its properties were to identify ahead of time whether it would respond or not, then you could actually save valuable healthcare resources, so you'd save the healthcare system money. You'd stop the patients having to be exposed to something that might have kind of nasty side effects and won't benefit them, and only those patients that will benefit will be treated with a particular agent. So I think it benefits the patients enormously, and I think it will benefit the healthcare system as well. So that I see this as being a real sea change in how healthcare is going to be delivered.
When you look at where you are now in terms of cancer research and all this technology that's coming on at this tiny, tiny scale, and look back to what it was like when you first started, what has the change been? What was it like for you in the beginning?
Oh, the change is, it's basically night and day. I mean, in the early days, we couldn't look at genes. We couldn't look at the properties of individual cells. We didn't have the tools to actually look at cancers, anything more than a lump. A lump, sure, that was composed of cells, and you could make a slice of it, and the pathologist could look at it and say, well, gee, it looks like this. But the kinds of things that could be done in labs now are almost totally different from the kinds of things that, say, could have been done 20 years ago. And I think with the new technology we're developing that it will be another really dramatic change in that now we'll go one step, well, actually probably many steps, more sophisticated in terms of the way we can diagnose and classify and identify the vulnerabilities of particular cancers in particular patients.
All of this new technology sounds wonderful because there's always the idea that we'll be able to treat things better. But are there any other concerns for the public?
Actually, I'm really glad you asked that question because I think there are, and I think we need to deal with them right at the beginning when the technology is first being developed so that the public actually knows what's coming, they know what the potential is, and they can actually make informed choices for what should be the social policy, not only for Canada, but for the world. But I think Canada is going to be a real leader in that. So the downside, if you like, is that the potential exists if we can, on a little micro device, identify the complete genetic profile of a cancer in a matter of minutes for, say, $2 to $5. That means we also, in theory, could identify the entire genetic profile of the whole person in a matter of minutes and very cheaply, perhaps even without them knowing it. And clearly that would not be a good thing for society. So I think the public has to be very well informed about this, and I think it's our responsibility as researchers to make sure as we develop the technology that we actually educate people. We educate the government, we educate the end users, the people that would actually use it, and in my mind, probably most importantly, that we educate the general public to say what the technology can do and what the risks might be and what the benefits might be. And then I think we need an ongoing public consultation where we say, okay, here's what we can do. These are the benefits. Here's the risks. What's important to you? What risks are you willing to take to gain the benefits? And what risks are you not willing to take? And so that we end up developing devices that will do things that the public finds that are socially beneficial and ethically beneficial and that they can live with.
So in a sense, we look at the debate around stem cell research, for example, and it's caused a lot of controversy. And what you're saying is that we need to avoid that sort of thing when it comes to the development of nanotechnology.
I think that's just really important because it does have the potential to change our lives. And we, and I don't exclude myself from the general public. There's a lot of these things that I don't know much about either, and I want to be consulted. And I think probably everybody else feels that way too. We want to have input into what's going to be done because it's going to affect our lives. So what we're doing to address that, we're trying to organize a large national initiative that will bring people across Canada together to develop these devices to actually do not just genetic analysis of cancer, but environmental analysis, air and water quality, with what's going on this week, terrorism sorts of things. You could actually rapidly analyze a white powder and say, do we need to worry about it or not? That kind of initiative is going to involve ethicists, so we have people who really think about what ethical implications of things are and can advise us on that. We're going to have people who are really experienced in health law, who can actually say what are the legal implications, and sociologists who can actually say what are the social implications and what are the privacy issues and how do we address the public and get their input into what we're doing. And, of course, that becomes important economically as well because companies don't want to develop something that the public's going to refuse to use, that they're going to protest against and say, we never wanted this, why did you do it? We want to be able to have things that when they get to the point of being commercialized and being economically important for Canada, people are all agreement, yes, this is what we want, and these are the controls we want in place to make sure it's not misused. So I think that's just key to all of the things NINT will do and all of the things that we as scientists associated or not associated with NINT will be doing.
You see that as being a need, an overriding need, something that needs to be dealt with. But on the other hand, what about the public, the guy on the street? How do you even begin to understand the implications of things that you can't even spell the names of?
I think the general public is actually very intelligent. And I think if it's properly explained, and it's our responsibility to do that, they can understand what are the benefits and what are the risks and start to ask themselves, for me personally, where's the balance? What's important? A cancer patient might say, well, I think the most important thing is that my cancer gets analyzed so that I can get better. And a criminal might say, well, gee, I'd prefer you didn't do any genetic sequencing at all. And people in the middle are going to be in the middle. I'd like some of these benefits, but I really don't want I don't want my genetic code on record. And that's certainly what I'd say. I want the medical benefits, but I don't want to be in somebody's database. And so we need to deal with those. And I think if we deal with them now, we as a society can develop what we consider to be socially and ethically acceptable before we're faced with a whole developed array of stuff that we can't do anything about anymore.
Certainly food for thought. Thank you very much, Linda.
Okay, you're welcome. It was really a pleasure talking to you.
That was Dr. Linda Polarski, cancer researcher associated with the Cross Cancer Institute, the University of Alberta, and the National Institute for Nanotechnology. Another woman making strides in the field of nanotechnology is chemist Dr. Deborah Ralston of the Naval Research Lab in Washington, D.C. Deborah was in Edmonton recently to discuss her work on fuel cells and nanostructured materials with other nanoscientists at the University of Alberta. Deborah is also known for her outspoken criticism of the underrepresentation of women in tenured faculty positions at post-secondary institutions. And her statistics show that while the number of women graduating with PhDs in science has risen dramatically over the last three decades, they're still bumping up against a male-dominated hierarchy when it comes to getting hired. I talked with Deborah after listening to her presentation, Why Science and Engineering Must Adapt to Women.
I think I've always been observant, so I've been literally an uppity feminist since I was about five. So I've had a history of questioning male authority, and that has continued. And I've written on this issue since the early 90s, but a lot of it, I think, gets brought home as you become more senior in your professional path, and you can look back and see things that were unfair, opportunities you were not given, things that you were told cannot be done, yet they would be turned around and handed to your male colleagues. And as these things happen to women in science, they, for the most part, just keep plowing through. You know, they're there because they love the science, there are things they want to get done, and they just keep going for it. But when you see it happen to the younger women who you've trained or mentored, you just get furious.
You showed some pretty startling statistics tonight in terms of the number of women who are going through being trained as PhDs and then what happens to them afterwards. What does your data tell you?
Well, we've done better in some disciplines, less well than others, but the trend has been more and more women earning PhDs in all the science and engineering disciplines with time. The life sciences are doing very well. They're over 40%. They're broaching the demographics with respect to the population, particularly in the United States, of men and women who go to college. My discipline is chemistry. We're sort of in the middle of the pack. A third of our PhDs in the late 1990s went to women, and we're sort of holding at that general level right now. Computer science and math are down in the 20s, and then engineering and physics are sort of in the 15% range. So it is discipline dependent, but the numbers are better than they were 10 years ago, and they're much better than they were 20 and 30 years ago. So we've created a wealth of talented women in science and engineering in our country, in Canada, in Europe. And these women are frequently the best in their graduate class. They do outstanding research, and then it's as though they've fallen off the face of the earth. We don't see those women back in positions of authority and influence in science and engineering. And that would be doing research in the best universities in your country. That would be running research groups and teams in industrial laboratories and national and federal laboratories, running your own company, perhaps running a professional society. It's where are these great women?
You suggested that actually these institutions are beating science out of women, beating the love of science out of them. Why do you say that?
That was brought home to me by one of my postdoctoral associates. She came out of one of the Ivy League universities in the United States, and so very prestigious educational path, and knew a lot of students. She's a great networker, so she's not somebody who just was sort of isolated from her world at this Ivy League school. She knew a lot of her fellow graduate students and postdocs. And she can look back, having been out of that university now over 7 years, and just really see these people she knew well who were bright, who were ambitious, who pretty much just burnt out by their experience at this Ivy League school. And then she looked at my path. I came out of the University of North Carolina, which in my particular discipline was a top five school. And I was working in a PhD program with a research advisor who has just trained some wonderful people over his 40 years of being in the university system. And my former postdoc has now met maybe somewhere between 10 and 15 of these former PhDs of my old PhD advisor. And she goes, "You come out of that group and they still love science. They love to talk about science. They love to kind of grapple with scientific issues." And she can look at the people she came through with, and there's only a handful who still want to do that. And so it really does matter what the environment is in which you're trained, in which you do your research. You still work hard, but that human aspect of it can make all the difference.
You've also observed that women actually have to work harder, and not even to get as far. Why is that? What's happening there?
Well, fortunately, that's not a statistic I just made up. The sociologists and the psychologists have done studies for decades to look at how men and women are acculturated in their particular society. And this inbuilt sense we have, men and women, that the man is just the better deal. He might be smarter or stronger or isn't going to get pregnant and disappear. Just that if you're going to bet on a person with staying power in a profession, maybe you should bet on the man. And so we have statistics that show that when the quality of the education and the productivity is the same, the preference is still to hire the man. So you can have, if you will, equal candidates and a preference for the man.
You've been focusing around something called Title IX, and you've actually gotten somewhere with it. What is Title IX, and what are you doing?
It's a 30-year-old law in the United States, and it was pushed by the recognition that industries, companies, but particularly universities who had federal funds actually had to not discriminate. And so it was pushed to get women into graduate programs in law school, in medical school, in engineering, science programs. And so it simply says that thou shalt not discriminate on the basis of sex in any educational activity that receives federal funds. In the United States, it's infamous because there were many court cases where people tried to get it applied with respect to women's sports in the universities and the high schools. And it took a lot of lawsuits, but it was finally agreed that, yes, you cannot discriminate in the athletics programs. And people have felt that it's perhaps been overapplied, that the male sports programs in colleges have suffered because the university has had to put resources into the women's athletics program. But one very interesting statistic is that now 42% of the collegiate athletes in the United States are female.
How do you apply that to science then?
The thinking again is it's still a federal activity to be a faculty member. And therefore, if you can look at the statistics to show that there is this candidate pool of women with PhDs who are potential faculty members, and for some reason you cannot hire them, then that is a statistical imbalance that is potentially addressable by Title IX, which can get federal funds removed.
Now, how key is that, having the funds?
Well, again, that's where the sports have been very instructive. There is no university in the United States that's lost funding for a Title IX breach. And yet there's just this huge fear that they'll come in, they'll get audited, and they'll lose their funds. And so Title IX has been a threat. It's been a mechanism to bring attention to equal treatment to men and women in the university system. And so people are first clued to it as for students, predominantly for sports, but the law is far more encompassing than that, and it can also be applied to faculty. As far as I know, the primary use in the early days was to get the faculty club on campus open to the women faculty. They had to sue for that because they were forced to use the wives club. And they said, I'm faculty, can't I use the faculty club? And so, as far as I know, that was really the primary use in the early days of Title IX with respect to faculty. It's predominantly been focused on students.
On your list of things that needs to change, at the top was daycare. Why?
My friends, my female friends in the university, are very proud of me for putting that first because I have no children. My biological clock was not set at the factory. That wasn't something that I made a conscious, agonizing choice. I've just never really felt the need to have children. But a woman and a man who have children and want to be real parents, they cannot just ignore those kids. And so anything the university does with the modern world has to incorporate family responsibilities. And children are going to be a huge part of that. So that has to be number one on the list, this recognition that young men and young women coming in to create strong careers are also going to have families, and you can't expect them to ignore that.
Your Title IX effort caught the attention of a senator in the Congress, and you actually ended up with something in a bill that was signed by President Bush. What does that say? What does that act mean?
It's really the starting point. You've got to have numbers. You have to have the statistics. You can't just run on instinct or suspicion or a story you've heard. You really do need numbers. So the Congress recognized that. They authorized the National Science Foundation to fund studies that would generate numbers with respect to science and engineering faculty in the United States. Now, there's not enough money to do this with the breadth and the depth that needs to be done. So the National Research Council, which is the study arm of the National Academy of Sciences, is doing a study looking at gender differences in faculty in science and engineering and math, but they've had to sort of down-select the universities they'll look at. They can't look at them all. The RAND Corporation is looking at the federal R&D investment as on the function of gender, but they'll probably start with the NSF funds, the National Science Foundation funds. And my bet is they'll probably look pretty good because NSF has been in the forefront in the United States at trying to diversify how the funding's gone out the door. And then to me, the most intriguing study was, again, spearheaded by Senator Ron Wyden at Oregon with Barbara Boxer from California as his ally to go to the General Accounting Office to get an audit of a handful of universities and national laboratories with respect to Title IX compliance in science and engineering and math. And to me, that's the study that will come out first, and it may have the most impact because the GAO is the congressional audit arm.
For a young woman listening to this who is considering a career in science, what do you say to her?
Science is outstanding. I mean, you can see why people do it around the clock because it's always a challenge. There's always something new to learn, and it's constant exploration. It's the most intellectually stimulating thing I can imagine doing, and if that's what you want to do with your mind and your life, science is a really great way to do it. But I also think that we have to be more encompassing of patterns that are not around the clock. People who can put in a 50-hour week and still build in the other things in their life that need to be done. We can still have great science done that way. So I might work around the clock, but I don't insist my staff work around the clock, and I don't insist our postdocs work around the clock. And we get a lot of really great science done. So it is doable. It can be done in a good collegial teamwork fashion. And when that happens, you have people who want to work with you, who want to come and do research with you, who want to collaborate. I have no trouble getting American postdocs at the Naval Research Laboratory, and those are premium product. I work at a Navy lab. I have to have U.S. citizens, and I have no trouble attracting them. And it's because it's fun science. Nano is on the cutting edge, and people know our reputation for getting interesting stuff done in a good working environment.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Deborah Ralston, chemist and nano researcher with the Naval Research Lab in Washington, D.C. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, the Science Alberta Foundation, University of Lethbridge, Alberta Research Council, Alberta Ingenuity, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Ducks Unlimited Canada, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, and the Alberta Conservation Association. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.